Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon. Good morning. Please turn your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. It's great to see everyone. I had a really good meeting last week up in Lexington, and there are a number of people there who have connections with a number of our people here, and several of them said to tell you hello. So as Jim has done when he's been away on meetings, you can consider yourself helloed from the folks in Lexington, and those of you who would receive that know who you are. But it's great to be home. It's great to be back, and what a wonderful blessing. As Darrell mentioned, and isn't it a blessing to have Darrell back from his most recent trip? We're grateful for the good things that God accomplished through us and through him during his most recent time in China. And also, it was a great day yesterday, as he mentioned, to see so many people up here working to beautify the grounds and repair things that needed fixing. And I know that there are so many who do so much here, not only yesterday, but people who teach, people who do little behind-the-scenes things on a regular basis, people who tend to one another, which is first and foremost a priority for us here. And I want you to know that we appreciate so very much what so many of you do. In the book of Ecclesiastes, we're learning some powerful lessons. Some of it's a sobering sort of slap in the face, a wake-up call, a reality check. These could all be words to describe what Solomon does for us in the book of Ecclesiastes. And much of the book takes place from a perspective that we would describe as under the sun. That's actually his terminology. A view of life that's somewhat akin to what we might call a secular view of life. What would the world look like? What would our lives mean if we excluded God, eternity, a life to come from the equation, then what sense could we make of this life purely by our observation and by the application of our human reason? And Solomon concludes over and over again, not very much. It doesn't go very far. But in the passage that is before us this morning, we have one of the places where God, where Solomon opens up the window shades to heaven and lets God clearly come through, and what a difference it makes. These are some of the most profound and encouraging words to me in all of Scripture. They're not necessarily the most pleasant words to me, but they are words that have been very significant in helping me shape my outlook on life and what happens to me as I go through this life under the sun. I think that if you can understand verses 1 through 15 of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, two wonderful things can happen in your life. Number one, you will be able to endure disappointment, even things that are quite tragic in your life, without being devastated. And number two, you will be able to enjoy the good things in your life to a much, much greater degree than a person who doesn't grasp the content of what Solomon is teaching us here. So if you're a person who whose life just gets blown up when something bad happens, or a person who just can't seem to find much satisfaction or enjoyment from the simple pleasures of life, these verses are for you. And I hope that they'll be as impactful in your life as they are in mine. There's a lot of different things that can disappoint us and set us back. My day sometimes when I'm not thinking in Ecclesiastes 3 like I should be, I'm always looking for the shortest checkout line at the grocery store. I'll spend 30 minutes trying to figure out which one is going to save me 30 seconds. And so I always get in the line that I think is going to be the shortest line. And God is always looking down and saying, Lawrence needs to learn a lesson. And it may look like the shortest line, but I'll guarantee you, people who haven't even come into the store yet are going to get checked out in the line next to him before he gets up to be checked out. And when you are thinking, that can be pretty devastating and put you in upset mood. But if you're thinking in the Ecclesiastes 3 groove, then when that happens to you, what you can do is just shake your head and laugh and say, well, there it is. That is what it is. I'll get there when I get there and move forward. And we will also be able to take the good things, the blessings, the people, the relationships, the food, the sunshine, the house that you live in. All of these things are going to be much more satisfying to you when you get the perspective that he wants us to get out of this section of the book. Before we dive into the section itself, which we're going to get to quickly, I want to sort of give us a lens through which to read these words, because I think that they are generally not read right. They're generally not understood properly. Solomon is contrasting in verses 1 through 8, which are rather familiar to us, largely because of the song that the birds recorded in the 70s. But these are words that are contrasting two perspectives on life. God's perspective and man's perspective, and who is who in this relationship. He tells us first what God's perspective is, and when we go outside of Ecclesiastes 3, this will become very clear to us. So I want us to bring a few passages outside of Ecclesiastes 3 into our thinking. I'm not going to encourage you to turn here, just stay at Ecclesiastes 3, but I want to read to you a couple of passages that show us God's perspective on all the things that are happening under the sun, all the things that are happening in your life, in my life, in America, in China, in Russia, wherever you are in the world, what's going on, how does God interact and how does he see all of that? Isaiah the prophet put it this way, remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. So Isaiah depicts God's perspective as not only one that's, you know, looking at the world from a distance, but looking at time through an eternal perspective. I think 48 years old. I never can remember how old I am. Janice has to always answer that question for me. But I think I've got 48 years of perspective. And I've read some history, and I've watched the History Channel a few times. So I've got, you know, that going for me too. So there's some things that I can get this picture of what life is like. But in reality, isn't that so very limited? God is stepping back and saying, I see everything, and I see everything from beginning to end, from before the day in which there was anything to be looked at in terms of creation. Before he said, let there be light, God was able to look forward and see every detail that was going to come to pass all the way through to the end of time and beyond. It is an eternal perspective of God. And that's what makes him God. That's why he is unique and in a category entirely of his own. None of us have that sort of perspective that God has on things and on time. In Psalm 139, he brings that down to a personal level. One of my favorite passages where the psalmist celebrates this perspective of God and applies it in a personal way. He says, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, that I know full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before any of them came to be. I think I know what I'm doing for lunch today. Janice and I talked about that. She told me last night, I forgot. She had to remind me again this morning. But right now, I know what's around the corner for lunch. I have some plans sketched out for tomorrow. And a few things that get a little bit more vague as the days and weeks and months and years go ahead until finally I have no idea. But this tells us that not only does God see the big picture from beginning to end, but he understands and knows every detail of every individual's life from beginning to end. All the days of my life were ordained for me, written in God's book before one of them came to be. And so as Romans 8 reminds us in verse 28, he is able to work all things together for the good of those who love him. So that's God's perspective. And then we have man's perspective, which as we've already mentioned is very limited and is well illustrated in a couple of ways. Our perspective on history, on time, and on our lives is very much like a person standing in front of a vast mural. Imagine a painting that is just massive, that would just cover the entirety of the wall behind me. And yet, we're walking up to it and we're standing right about this far away looking at a tiny piece of it. I had to start wearing glasses when I was just a little guy. And I'll still remember going to the eye doctor, which I thought was the coolest thing, looking through all this stuff. And the doctor turning to my mother in the exam room and saying, I believe he has myopia. I didn't remember the word exactly, but I remember the feeling that I had when I heard that. Oh, no. This is terrible. I've got some terrible disease. You know, I'm going blind. Come to find out, this is just the fancy doctor word for he's nearsighted. He needs some glasses. He can't see things very clearly very far away. He's got to get right up close if he's going to be able to see them. And if I take my glasses off, you're all just blurry as can be. So we're nearsighted. We have to get our face right up. That's all we can see, is just what's right in front of us. So when we look at this grand mural of all eternity, of all time and all the events and all the people that live in the world, we're looking at just the tiniest fragment of the big picture. And yet God sees the whole thing without losing sight of the most minute detail. That's his perspective versus mine. Another illustration would be a tapestry. And if there's a loom, some of you know what we're talking about, in which a weaver is taking all of these different threads, threading them together, from underneath the loom, all you see is a bunch of gnarled strands and knots. But on the other side of the loom, from the top side of the loom, it's a beautiful tapestry being woven together in intricate detail and design. And so it is for us. We are under the loom, looking up, seeing all kinds of things that just don't make sense, appear to be dead end. Why this color here? Why that not there? But on the top side, from God's perspective, it is a beautiful whole. And so that's the perspective that is in view here. And the perspective is that God is the one not only who sees it, but God is the one who is weaving it. God is the one who is painting it. He is in control of the events of history as they unfold. It is God who is in control and not me. Now that's where this can sometimes become rather unpopular with us. We'd much rather think that we're in control of everything. I'm calling all of the shots. But the reality is that we control extremely little, mostly simply our attitude and our reaction to the events that come before us, but very little control over the events themselves. And that's what this passage is highlighting. These verses remind us that we have been placed in a world we did not create and which we do not control. Verses 1 through 8 are not advice on how you need to act at a given point. It is a declaration of what God has done, and we are in the mix of it. And so with that in view, let's read verses 1 through 8. If you underline your Bible, two words you might want to underline in verse 1. One is everything, and the other is a season or a time. For everything, there is a season. For every matter under heaven, there is a time. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. Now let me try to reemphasize the point that this is not just advice for how we are supposed to act, but just the realization that this is what God is doing, and we are mere participants in that grand scheme. He says, first and foremost, there's a time to be born and a time to die. Now, who among us, be bold now, prior to your birth, sat in heaven and told God, okay, this is the day, these are the parents, this is the time and place and circumstances in which I want to be born? And God said, oh, okay, we'll do that just like you said. I remember seventh grade. Up to this point in my life, I had been nothing but football. Football was everything. I could not wait to put on the pad. Seventh grade is when we started doing that back in the day. And I was excited, and I remember getting out there the first day, putting on the pads and going up to the coach and saying, now, when do we tell you what position we're going to play? And the coach, you know, just looking at me and brushing me aside. We don't tell him what position we're going to play. He will tell us what position we're going to play. I didn't tell God. Lawrence Kelly, 1968, Amarillo, Texas, born to Charles and Jean Kelly. I had no say in that. And the reality is, I do not pick the day in which I will die. These times are in the hand of God. We know that that's the truth because of the passages that we have already read. But I'm also reminded of an interesting story in the Old Testament. In the book of 1 Kings, there's a wicked guy by the name of Ahab, who's like the worst dictator you could ever imagine. And a prophet was sent to him to tell him, do not go into battle because you are going to be killed in this battle. But he decided he could outsmart what the prophet had said because he would disguise himself. He would wear the armor of an ordinary soldier. And he got another king who was going into battle with him to dress up really fancy. And I've always thought this other king must not have been too quick on the uptake, because he was like, okay, sounds great. You know, we know they're going to be going after you, Ahab. I'll dress up like you, and you dress up like an ordinary soldier. Well, Ahab dresses up like an ordinary soldier. He goes out into the battle. Everything's going according to plan. They're chasing after the other guy. He's just sort of sitting there calling the shots, watching what's going on. And then the scripture says that an archer drew his bow, it says, at random, and fired an arrow. And the arrow flew through the air and found one little spot between the plates of armor in Ahab's suit. Pierced him, and he bled out in the chariot and died. We may think that we set these kinds of parameters. And certainly it is true that God uses means. The application is not, well, I'll just go out and walk across the traffic without looking both ways. I'll run red lights. I'll quit taking my medicine. No, you use all due precautions. Yet knowing that the very number of your days is as known to God as the number of hairs on your head. And for some people, that totally freaks them out. And for others, for the wise, it is an enormous comfort. But not only our birthday and our death day, but every day in between. He says there is a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. And again, the point is, who decides all of this? We have farmers in our congregation. How do you decide when it's time to plant the soybeans and when it's time to harvest the wheat? The answer to that, the farmers would tell us, is not me. Now, maybe within a very small window of opportunity, I decide that. But by and large, God, who has ordained the course of nature, determines when the beans are to be sowed and when the wheat and the corn is to be harvested. It is not me who is in control of that. I simply have to go with what God has ordained. And so there's a time to kill, he says, and a time to heal. You spend your years tending to your pets, nurturing your animals, making sure they're healthy and strong, and still the day comes when you have to put them down. A time to break and a time to build up. A city rejoices in this glorious stadium that it has built, and only a generation later it is blown up and collapsed. One ruler establishes a city and builds it up and fortifies it with walls or with a missile defense mechanism, and not very long after, a king that is greater than he comes in and levels it, and not one stone is left standing upon another. Now, if it's left to us, if it's left to you and me, we would make it this into a buffet. Verses 1 through 8 would be our buffet, right? Here's the line. I know I keep using references to food. I'm sorry. There's the line. We're going to go through the buffet and we're going to pick the things that we like. You know, a time to be born? Yes. A time to die? No. No, thank you. None of that, please. I'll take some laughter. I'll take a little bit of dancing, not too much. Church of Christ, not too much, but a little bit. A time to cry and a time to laugh. I'll take the time to laugh. In fact, I want to laugh till I cry, but no, just weeping, please. A time to embrace, a time to refrain. I'll take embracing. A time to find, a time to lose. I'll take finding over losing anytime. A time to keep and a time to cast away. Oh, I like to keep. I like to gather. I like to be getting. I like to be increasing. I like the portfolio to be growing. I don't want the day to come where I just throw it all away because none of it even matters anymore. A time to keep silent. No, I'm a preacher. No, thank you. A time to love and a time to hate. I'll take love every time. A time for war and a time for peace. I'll definitely give peace a chance. But that's just the point. I don't get to pick, do I? When the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, war is upon you. And it doesn't matter how much you don't like it. War is here. And this is the time in which you now must live. I don't choose the colors for the portion of God's great mural that my life is being painted with. And so we come to verses 9 through 15, which give us three observations and drive to one inevitable and great conclusion. Let's read together beginning in verse 9. What gain then is the worker from his toil? I've seen the business of God that God has given the children of man to be busy with. So here's all the things that God puts into our life, all these things that seem so random to us and that we have to give ourselves to. What does it all mean? It concludes verse 11, three things in verse 11. See if you notice them as we read through it. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful, to do good as long as they live, also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or nothing can be taken from it. God has done it so that people will fear before him. That which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. The three observations that he makes are found all in verse 11. And the first of them is that he has made everything beautiful in its time. So he's saying there is a purpose to all of it, though that purpose may not be seen to us. There's a reason for the joy and the sorrow. There's a reason for the birth and for the death, for the mourning and the laughter. Now, the interesting thing about you and me is that we don't usually question, we don't have why questions for the good things. I've never heard a person say, why baskets full of kittens? Why rainbows? Why birthday cakes and unicorns? Or maybe people do wonder about that. But why all these blessings? Why all these pleasant things? I don't understand why there's so many good things in life. No, we don't say that. But we do often question the hurricanes, the wolves, the diseases. But what Solomon is telling us here is that God is putting the perfect amount of dark and light elements into the story of the world in order to maximize its beauty. Behold, He makes all things beautiful in its time. And I take that to mean that ultimately when the story is told, when everything is said and done, every single element of the grand mural will be perfectly placed. All of the colors will be just right. And the contrasting material of dark and light, the ratio and proportion will have been exactly what it ought to have been. Nothing will be missing. Nothing should be added. Nothing should be taken away. See, no doubt, Ansel Adams' photographs. Great black and white nature scenes that typically portray stark contrast between lights and darks. And there's one particular of a tree that's been blown by the wind, and it's gnarled and curved, and it's in a desolate, rocky place. And yet it's there, it's hanging on, and there's the shadow and the darkness and the light of the sun that's hitting it from one angle. And you may say, well, I like the life that's there, but not all the stark elements, not the heroism of this tree hanging in there in the most unlikely and severe of places, but yet that's part of the beauty. The picture itself would actually be quite dull and boring if you took away all the dark elements and just had the nice elements. And so I'm saying that to say that those of you who love all the baskets of kittens and puppies and the butterflies floating on a spring breeze need to come to appreciate and embrace the hurricane, the tornado as well. For the same God that appoints the one appoints the other. And He does so for good reason. And ultimately will make all things beautiful in its time. And those of you who just are moody and dark and brooding, hey, lighten up. And there are such things as beautiful butterflies floating on the breeze. Enjoy that. It's a gift of God. Now, another way to help, I think, put this together is a story that's pretty familiar, particularly to young people, but the Harry Potter series. Really well done series of books, and then the movies made after them. Well, if J.K. Rowling, who's the author of this series, what if she leaves out all of the dark elements of the story? There's no Voldemort, right? There's no Death Eaters. There's no Dementors. Take all those out of the story. How good is the story? How many copies does this sell? How many times will you sit and watch a movie where none of those things are present? We want a J.K. Rowling that only writes pretty things, pleasant things, baskets of puppies things, boring things, right? Every critic would read the story and say, absolutely a waste of your time, not worth watching, not worth reading. Because, in part, when you take all of those dark elements out, you also have to take out all the things that make the story so compelling and lovely to you. You have to take away the love, the friendship, the self-sacrifice, the hope, the courage, all of these things that are brought to the fore as they are brought to meet and contrast with the dark elements. These things also disappear along with the evil. Now, if you are Ron Weasley or Harry Potter or Hermione Granger, and you are locked inside the story, if you can imagine with me here, there are no doubt going to be moments as this story unfolds that you're thinking to yourself, this J.K. Rowling is an evil person. Why is she doing this to me? How could this be happening to me? If she has any decency about her, she would not be letting this part of the story happen the way it's happening right now. But you and I, as an observer, as a reader from outside the story, are getting a little bit of that eternal perspective that God has, and we can look on it and say, no, that's good. That's just the way it ought to be. And here's the opportunity for this character to rise up and to be what they can be, and that they would never have become apart from this challenging and difficult part appearing in the story. So from where we sit, we see the beauty. And when we know the whole story, we say, it's beautiful. And every part in its time and place, though in that moment seemed out of place, now I see how it all fits together. And I can assure you that J.K. Rowling or J.R. Tolkien are nothing in compared with the story, the ultimate story writer, who is painting a picture, who is telling a story, who is creating a symphony with all the perfect notes. And the day will come when you and I, if we love and stick with Him and trust in Him, we'll look back and see the whole sweep of it and say, yes, it is just right. It is beautiful. Secondly, in verse 11, he also says, and He has put eternity in man's heart. He has put it within us to want to see how the whole story fits together. And in particular, how my part of the story fits with the whole, how my time meshes in with the eternal scope and picture of what God is doing. I long to see that. He's put that in my heart, a desire to understand these things. And that's why we're plagued with this. This is why we try and are struggling to try to figure it out, to make sense of things. We cannot help but do so. And that's what part of what makes us unique as human beings, isn't it? Your dog, smart as it is, cute as it is, doesn't sit around and wonder, what does it all mean? And doesn't think about, you know, the day's going to come that I'm going to die and leave all this, and then what will it matter? Now, humans uniquely possess this eternity in our hearts and this desire to know how our story fits in with the eternal whole. Your dog is satisfied with this world only because your dog was made for this world only, but you and I are not. And this is why the secular vision is failing and must necessarily fail. We'll always fail because God has put eternity in our hearts. And He's filled our souls with a void that nothing but He and eternity can fill. And so that's why we long for the answer. But thirdly, this is the most difficult part. He tells us in the end of verse 11, yet he, that is you and I, mankind, cannot find out what God has done from beginning to the end. You can think about it. You can apply yourself to trying to figure it all out, to make it all make sense, and you're still going to run into situations that you can't explain. So you may want to come to me after the sermon and say, preacher, you said God's going to make everything beautiful in His time, but you tell me how this particular instance in my life or in someone that I love's life, how that ever can work out to be something that will be beautiful from an eternal perspective. And my answer to that is probably going to be verse 11c, I can't find it out. I don't see that. But I'm not going to lose faith in the fact that God, who does see everything, does see it. And abandoning that hope does not help anything whatsoever. You know, I think that there's a rule that no parent can get past stage 4 with a kid in the why stage. You know, that's the stage that they're in where they're like, everything is mom, dad, why? 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 We try to answer it for about 2, maybe 3 times on a good day, but the fourth time the why comes back, it's just, that's just the way it is. You would not understand it even if I tried to explain it to you. And there are just going to be some riddles in life that we are not going to be able to explain. Now, I do believe, very likely, that in eternity that will also be made evident and clear to us. But while we're living under the sun, we'll have to be satisfied with the tension and the mystery and the paradox. And that leads us then, drives us down to one great application that he makes in verses 12 and 13. And again, that's where he says, so I perceive, this is my conclusion, that there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So God's going to make it all work out. I long to see how that's going to happen, but I can't quite figure it out. So what am I going to do in the meantime? I'm going to walk in the sunshine. I'm going to sit down at my table and eat my food and drink my drink and love my family. And I'm going to work as hard as I can. I'm going to throw myself into my work, do as much good as I can as long as I live, and trust God to just simply take all that and weave it and work it into the masterpiece that He is writing that he is painting. Now, some of us this morning are unable to enjoy these pleasures of life that God has given to us. And you can't enjoy them because you're holding on to them so tightly that you're squeezing all the joy out of them. And so people are wondering and they're worried, well, what if I lose my looks? What if I lose my boyfriend or my girlfriend? What if I lose my health? What if I lose my job? What if I lose my baby? And I can assure you, here's the hard truth. You will, at one point or another, before it's all said and done, lose all of them. And you won't pick and choose when that place in life happens. And if you're living your life with a constant dread of losing them, you will never be able to enjoy them during the fleeting time that they are yours to enjoy. But if you entrust them to God, and all the fleeting moments of life you put in His hands and say, God, I believe You've got it. I don't. I can't control it. I can't hold on to it. I can't make it all work out. But I believe that You can, and I will give that care of it over to You. I know that not one bird, one sparrow is going to fall to the ground apart from Your knowing it and Your governance. No one's going to die in my family because You dropped the ball and looked away for a second. You've got it under control. I'm going to trust You to do that, that You're going to work it all out beautifully in the end. And in the meantime, while You've put them in my hands and in my place, I'm going to love it. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to live it. That's an amazing application that Solomon leads us to here. Some of us can't enjoy God's gifts because we are always wishing that they were different than what they actually are. He says, enjoy your food, your drink, your work, your family, your time and the place that God has assigned to you. But some of us are always wishing that we were somebody else. Or we were with somebody else. You know, my family, my friends, these people that I've stuck with, they're lame. Have you noticed that lameness just seems to follow some people around? Everything is always lame. Maybe there's a common denominator here. Maybe you're lame and you need to stop blaming everything and everything, including yourself and what's going on, and just say, no, it's good. It's a gift. I'll take it. I'll take what I've been given, and I'm going to leave here in just a moment, and I'm going to go with my people, my family that God has given me. I'm going to love them. I'm going to sit down at a table, and I'm going to like and enjoy what I eat and the conversation that we have and the beautiful air that God's given me today outside. I'm going to take it, and I'm not going to wish to be somewhere else. I'm not going to wish that it was tomorrow and I were at some other stage in my life or wish that it was yesterday and I could relive the past. I'm going to take today as the passing moment that God's giving me right now, and I am going to enjoy it. And then thirdly, some of us aren't enjoying our life because we feel like the best part of it is already behind us. And all that is left are the memories, and our memories are fading. Indy Wilson said, memories are the ghosts of moments. They are the fingerprints on the windows of the mind. We are always forgetting. We have all forgotten a great deal more of our lives than we remember. The last moment is constantly replaced with the next moment. Have you ever thought about the fact that you have 1 second to experience, process, and store in memory every second that occurs? There's a lot going on, and you better stick with it or you're gonna lose out in a hurry, right? And so we lose it. We lose most of it. As we age, we lose more and more, as I can well to attest. But God is eternal. Think about this. We're almost done. This is a good point. Trust me. God is eternal, and not one memory that you make, not one memory that you have ever made will ever be lost. He is the God who gathers up the fragments, and there's nothing lost. And this is the only reason, contrary to the secularist worldview, this is the only reason, because there is an eternal God who remembers everything. That is the only reason why everything matters. While every memory counts, while every decision counts, while every love that you've shared, while every act of service, word of kindness, all of them count because God doesn't forget a single moment of it. And He is storing every one of those memories in His bottle of remembrance. He is scrapbooking every hour of your life. And one day, in its completeness and in its eternal context, He is going to give it back to you. And if you've lived your life in faith to Him, what you will see will astonish you in its beauty. And so let me conclude. 1 Corinthians 15, something that Solomon is leaning into all the way back in his day, but he didn't have a clear perception of, that Christ makes crystal clear for us. Beginning in verse 54, 1 Corinthians 15, he writes, "When the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality, then will be brought to pass the saying that is written, 'Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain.'" That word vain is the word that Solomon has used so many times to describe. Life just seems so vain, so passing, so fleeting, so empty. We live all these things out and then we die, and then what does it matter? And Jesus comes and He lives and He dies and He rises again. And He offers eternal life to those who will follow Him, who will trust Him, who will believe in Him and obey Him. And He promises us that all that sting, that pain, that suffering that death and sin has introduced, He has plowed the way through it. And that this eternity can be brought to bear on our lives and everything becomes meaningful. Everything is fruitful, and not one work that the faithful Christian does in his life of living and loving and serving and enjoying God's gift, not one moment of it is lost. Not a bit of it is in vain. What a wonderful God we serve. And what a wonderful life we live. And what a wonderful thing it is that you and I are privileged to be together at this moment in time, at this place on the globe, to share our lives together, to encourage one another, to be reminded of these good things, and to live for God's glory, and then go home and be with Him, where we'll see it all brought back in wonderful color forever and forever. If you want to be a Christian, we invite you to participate in that. We'd love to talk with you about how you can become a Christian. Anything that you need prayers for, we'd be glad to help you with that as well. Let us know what your need is while we stand and while we sing.